The Guardian.
Hello and welcome to The Guardian Football Weekly. Today we pay tribute to Jack Charlton, one of 11 men to win the World Cup for England, and a man who transformed football in the Republic of Ireland in the 80s and 90s. And by all accounts, just a really good bloke. As his former side Leeds take another big step towards promotion to the Premier League, we'll look back at the weekend's games in the top division. Norwich are down, but after losing all the time since restart, the four sides above them all win, and bring up some new questions. Is it okay to kick someone if you're both in the net? And some old questions. What's a shoulder and what's an arm? And Manchester City, the only side in the top four to win at the weekend, and they will be in the Champions League next season after this morning's decision by the Court of Arbitration for Sport in what is a huge moment in European football. All that, plus your questions on today's Guardian Football Weekly. A lot for the panel to discuss today. Lars Sivertsen, good morning.
Good morning, Max. It's an honour to be invited onto to such a significant pod. There's loads going on today. It's exciting.
Absolutely right. Barry Glendenning, are you honoured?
I'm always honoured. I live in a state of constant honour-dom.
I don't think it's for you to say, to be fairly honest. The Racing Post's Mark Langdon. We have not spoken to you for time, Mark. How are you?
I'm good, thanks, Max. Yeah, the lockdown was extremely busy, but I think I'm now able to come out and play for other teams as well.
Excellent news. Well, look, we've got a lot to get through. If we don't talk about your team enough, we do apologise in advance. Let's start. And we will talk about, obviously, the huge verdict for Manchester City and the Court of Arbitration for Sport in a second. But let's begin with Jack Charlton. What a life and what a story. Along with Bobby and two other brothers, shared a bed growing up in a small house in Ashington, north of Newcastle. He briefly tried his hand at being a coal miner, didn't particularly like it, down pit. Apart from national service, spent his entire time at Leeds United. Went on to win the World Cup, transformed football in the Republic of Ireland. With Leeds, he won the league, the FA Cup, the League Cup, the Fairs Cup twice. Barry, you didn't know him, but he made a great impact on your life, didn't he?
Huge. I actually got the news on Saturday morning from you, Max. I woke up to a WhatsApp message saying Jack Charlton had died, and I went on the radio to talk about it. And I was actually surprised by how much it knocked me sideways. You know, I've never met the man. I didn't know him as a player at all. Obviously, I'm familiar with his work, but I never saw him play. But the contribution he made to Irish football can't be overstated. And I think the contribution he just made to Irish life in general can't be overstated. He took over in 1986. I was 14 years old at the time. And Ireland was at a very low ebb at that time. The troubles were ongoing. Unemployment was very high. Emigration was high. And people were just kind of miserable, to be honest. And this World Cup winner took over the Irish team. I don't think he was originally even supposed to get the job. And people were kind of nonplussed. A few eyebrows raised because he was the first foreigner ever to take the job, and he was an Englishman, and you know, at the time English people weren't particularly popular in Ireland. But he brought us incredible success. He took over a bad team, but a bad team that had a lot of good players and that had a lot of near misses, never qualified for any major tournament. And then they qualified for two in a row, and qualified for Euro 88, World Cup in 1990, and the World Cup in 1994. And we didn't just turn up, we competed. And we weren't always pretty on the eye, but we were very effective. And he gave our football team, our football fans, and the whole country just a lift, a confidence we never had before. And it's no surprise to me that a lot of Irish people were very upset that he died, because he wasn't just respected in Ireland. There was a genuine love for him.
Mm. I mean, when I spoke to you on the radio, and we have spoken a number of times, Barry, I don't often hear you get choked up about something. And I heard that emotion in your voice. I heard it in, you know, we spoke to Ray Houghton and Mick McCarthy, Tony Cascarino as well. And
Paul Howard, who is an Irish writer and of some repute, said, as you said, you know, Ireland wasn't a great place, and he said Jack Charlton was the man who taught me that things don't have to be shit. And
yeah, well, that's it in a nutshell.
Yeah,
absolutely.
And there are some brilliant stories about Jack Charlton with Ireland, and in Kevin Mitchell's obituary in the Observer, you know, he writes, he was nobody's fool, Jack Charlton. On his appointment as Ireland manager, he recalled, quote, "I told them it wasn't about the money, it was about the honour. They wrote a number on a piece of paper, put the paper face down on the table and slid it over to me. I looked at it and said, it's not that much of a fucking honour." And there were stories from, you know, Cass and Ray Houghton, which were just, I mean, there are so many stories of him as Ireland manager, but the one before the Italy game.
I listened to Cass and Ray Houghton talking to you and Charlie on the radio for half an hour. And to be fair, I don't know how they held it together, because they must have been incredibly close to him. I mean, the things he did for those players and remarkable, but I was just in tears laughing because there's so many funny stories. And he wasn't like a clown or anything. He didn't go out of his way to try to be funny. He was just a very warm, funny guy who seemed to light up any room he walked into.
There are a couple of stories that I think it's worth recounting. You may have heard them already, but before the Italy game, and they were on the bus going, it's in New York, right? And it's, you know, it's obviously a huge expat Irish community, huge Italian expat community. And they're on the bus wondering how many fans will be there from each side. And as they're getting closer and they get into the ground and it's a sea of green and they're all there, and Jack Charlton just turns to Cass and says, "You're the only Italian in here, Cass." And there was one story that I think Jarlath Regan told, who presents An Irishman Abroad, that podcast. He said there was an Ireland game where there were 12 names on the team sheet, and all the players are sitting there going, you know, they spot this 12 names on the team sheet. And eventually Andy Townsend says, "Gaffer, there's 12 names on that team sheet." And Jack Charlton says to Andy Townsend, who spotted that? And Andy went, "Oh, it was Niall Quinn." And Jack Charlton turns to Quinny and says, "Quinny, you're on the bench, son." but you know, with Ireland, we'll get on to England in a second, but Lars, with Ireland, like, tactically, you know, he people saying, like, he was pressing years before, you know, people talked to the press. He got the most out of his players.
Yeah, that's a way of putting it. There's a really interesting bit about that in some really fine writing, some very excellent obituaries worthy of the man have been put out. And I think one I particularly enjoyed was written by a sort of peripheral acquaintance of the show, Miguel Delaney, who had a good bit about the tactical aspect, about how he identified that at international level, a lot of the football sort of went kind of, it was quite compressed. It was all going through the middle. It was all going through the playmaker, and there were wide open spaces in behind that could be exploited. And that was a big part of why, you know, they hit those long balls that they did, you know, get the ball forward and press them, put them under pressure. And it might have looked slightly agricultural at times, but there was actually some quite sort of innovative thinking going on there, and some principles that we see are completely commonplace now. So that is definitely an interesting factor there.
Leeds United are planning a permanent memorial to him, perhaps naming a stand after him. And it's interesting. I knew he was a legend at Leeds, Mark. I didn't know he was a one-club man. I didn't know... I obviously knew he was vitally important to that team, but perhaps didn't realise quite how much. And also, he always underplayed his ability, but he was a really good player.
Yeah, I think that's probably the one thing that has come out for me, sort of reading the obituaries and when people are speaking about him, is actually how he downplayed his own ability. Clive Tildesley, the ITV commentator, sort of told a story about how during the World Cup final, when it was right, it's dying embers and the time was running out, he was screaming to Bobby Moore to just boot the ball into touch. And instead, Bobby Moore, of course, chipped it forward and Jeff Hurst made it 4-2. And it was at that moment Jack Charlton told the story of how he realised he, you know, could never be of that kind of ability. You know, he didn't have the kind of technical levels of Bobby Moore, And also Brian Glanville in his obituary in The Guardian, he wrote a story about actually Jack Charlton spoke to Alf Ramsey and questioned why he was in the England team during his tenure. And Ramsey said back to him that he, you know, it was all about the pattern and the team shape, and he wanted somebody physical next to Bobby Moore. And very interesting for somebody that, of course, went on to win a World Cup league title, FA Cup, League Cup, Intercity Fairs Cup, that he actually didn't rate himself that highly at times, knew what he was good at. Don Revy played him up front for a while, and he said himself that the number nine shirt just didn't suit him at all. And also saw in the Daily Telegraph obituary that Jack Charlton has been credited with kind of developing that tactic of blocking goalkeepers at corners. That was one that the kind of Leeds drew up, and one of the League Cup final successes over Arsenal. Actually, that was how one of the goals came about, with Jack Charlton blocking the goalkeeper. So he was somebody, of course, as well, that won Footballer of the Year in 1967. So I didn't see him play, but he obviously had a lot more ability than even he felt himself.
And his relationship with Bobby did change over the years, and family relationships do, but there was a really moving video that did the rounds on Sports Personality of the Year, where Bobby Charlton was being given an award and Jack presented it to him. And it's just a really move, just his turn of phrase and his delivery is so lovely when he says, you know, Bobby Charlton's the best footballer I've ever seen and he's my brother. And it was just a really moving moment. And Danny Baker's, I don't know if you saw Danny's tweet saying, look, possibly my favourite football story of all is how the morning after the World Cup final, Jack Charlton woke up in the living room floor of a couple from Dagenham he had no recollection of meeting. His winner's medal was still in his pocket. Good night, Giant. It's a lovely story. And he was a man who loved life. And I got that from doing that show on Saturday on the radio.
I think was another reason he was so loved in Ireland, because he was a real man of the people, and he was there at a time when there was no internet, there was no Twitter or Instagram, no mobile phones, and the Irish players used to regularly drink with the fans. You know, Irish players in pubs around their training ground and after games near the stadium. The Irish players loved going to play for Ireland because they weren't cloistered and treated like school children in the way other international teams are, specifically England, I suppose. They were allowed pretty much do what they wanted, and as long as the results were good, nobody cared. So journalists didn't grass them up, and fans didn't tut-tut and admonish them with finger wags. They were just allowed to get on with it. And I think that contributed a lot to their success, because they were a very, very happy camp.
Just one more story which made me laugh so much was the one about he sort of had some deal with Harry Ramsden's fish and chip shop, and he took the squad to a Harry Ramsden's the day before they played Austria. And Cascarino and Houghton were regaling this story that if you ate the biggest fish, you got it for free. And Gary Kelly ate the biggest fish. Got it for free. They said the next day, like, Tony Polster just ran rings around the whole Republic of Ireland team because they'd all eaten too much fish. What a great man, eh? Jack Charlton passed away at the age of 85. Before we end part one, a couple of pretty difficult stories to cover. One devastating piece of news from this morning about Spurs defender Serge Aurier's brother has been shot dead in Toulouse. It was around 5 o'clock this morning, according to Le Point and Europe One. We obviously extend our deepest sympathies and thoughts to his family. And before we move to the games in part two, the racist abuse of Wilfried Zaha and David McGoldrick online. On Sunday morning, Wilfried Zaha tweeted messages he'd received on Instagram. West Midlands police sent a tweet saying that we were alerted to a series of racist messages sent to a footballer today, and after looking into them and conducting checks, we've arrested a 12-year-old boy from Solihull. He's been taken into custody. Thanks to everyone who raised it, racism won't be tolerated. David McGoldrick, of course, scored his first two Premier League goals at the weekend, also received a hideous racist post on Instagram that he reposted. I don't really know what to say anymore. Clearly, social media companies, we know they have a responsibility to do more and act quicker. And I don't know if it's time to verify all accounts. I don't know if any of you have anything you can add to it.
Not really. I mean, I would just say I don't really see if there's anything to be gained by punishing a 12-year-old beggar's belief that that's in their head sort of thing. But yeah, I don't see the benefit of punishing a 12-year-old, but you can certainly educate one.
I think you're right. Look, that'll do for part one. It's obviously a story that we will come back to. Part two will begin with that verdict by the Court of Arbitration for Sport. Then Manchester City will be playing in the Champions League next season. Part two of the Guardian Football Weekly. Mark Langdon, Lars Sivertsen with me and Barry today. Now, tomorrow's pod, Barney Ronay and Tarek Panja from the New York Times are joining us, and we are going to look in the CAS verdict in detail. This news has literally just happened, but the CAS verdict says Manchester City did not disguise equity funding as sponsorship contributions, but did fail to cooperate with the UEFA authorities. Exclusion from participation in UEFA club competitions lifted, fine maintained, but reduced to 10 million euros. The CAS awards emphasised that most of the alleged breaches reported by the CFCB were either not established or time-barred. Manchester City's statement says, while Manchester City and its legal advisers are yet to review the full ruling by the Court of Arbitration for Sport, the club welcomes the implications of today's ruling as a validation of the club's position and the body of evidence that it was able to present. The club wishes to thank the panel members for their diligence and the due process that they administered. UEFA say over the last few years, financial fair play has played a significant role in protecting clubs and helping them become financially sustainable. And UEFA and ECA remain committed to its principles. We obviously haven't had time to read the whole statement. Like everyone else, we were speculating in the last few months and weeks and days about what might happen. Lars, what's your immediate reaction?
My immediate feeling is to think big picture, in the sense that it's very hard to imagine how UEFA can continue to enforce the financial fair play rules such as they are now, because I think the perception certainly will be that Man City did conceal payments or inflated payments on some. And the initial reports or the initial text doesn't actually rule that out. It simply says that those weren't established or were time barred. I hope we get more information on the exact process behind here, and I look forward to hearing the pod you record tomorrow when things are a bit more clearer. But I think it's going to be very hard to tell other clubs to live within the FFP rules. I mean, you think about clubs like Roma, who have had to, certainly according to their former sporting director Monchi, said that the reason they sold Mohamed Salah for the price they sold him to Liverpool was that they had to make the FFP rules they had to have money in by a certain date. So clubs have made, as much as people are cynical and think the FFP rules haven't changed the thing, I mean, there are lots of huge clubs out there who have made really tough decisions with very tangible sporting consequences in order to stay within these rules, and to now see Man City basically get away with what they're done, or certainly are perceived to have done. It just takes away the legitimacy and the moral authority of UEFA to keep enforcing these rules, I think. So it's hard to see how financial play can continue to be a thing.
UEFA are unlikely to make an appeal to the Swiss courts at this stage. That's what we're hearing right now. I mean, on the flip side, Barry, this is brilliant news for Manchester City. Pep Guardiola doesn't have to go anywhere. They keep their players. They are a brilliant football team, and they can carry on being a brilliant football team.
Yeah, it's I'm sort of simultaneously surprised and unsurprised by this decision, I suppose. It's a fantastic result for City. I would imagine many of their supporters will receive the good news with equanimity and grace and won't be busy on Twitter at all today. Going yeah, boo sucks and effing and jeffing at various journalists who they think have it in for their club. But I think Lars is right. They've broken financial fair play rules. They didn't cooperate with the investigation, and they've got a fine, which is, you know, 10 million is obviously a lot of money, but it's not to them. It's chump change. So yeah, good luck to them. I mean, the Champions League will be a better tournament for their presence in it, but I thought they should have been punished, but they haven't been, and good luck to them.
And I would also add that I understand a lot of people listening will not necessarily lament the passing of financial fair play, if that is what we're seeing, and if that's the long-term outcome of this, because it is an imperfect system. And I think the argument that it entrenches a certain moneyed elite has merit to it. The only thing is, the other side of the coin is that if there's no regulations in place for how much money external actors can sort of shove into a football club, there is a danger that the very sharp end of European club football just becomes a pissing contest between the richest petrostates in the world. And I think that's worse, personally. So I think some sort of regulation needs to be in place. And FFP seemed like the least bad idea people had come up with so far, for all its flaws. But again, how UEFA can continue to enforce it now is really hard to see.
As I said, Barney Ronay, Tariq Panja, join us tomorrow, and we will fully dissect this and its implications. On the pitch, Man City won 5-0 at Brighton, Raheem Sterling scoring a hat-trick. But let's look at some other games. And the relegation battle, fascinating weekend there. Norwich are down. They lost 4-0 at home to three-scoring West Ham. No one's ever said that before. Richard Jolly stat for you, the first of a few this pod. Mikel Antonio scored more Premier League goals at Carrow Road in 2020 than Norwich City. He's 4-3 up currently on Norwich. Norwich relegated with three games to spare, 13 points adrift now. Ossie says, can you please explain why Norwich get a lot of praise even though they're a poor team and deservedly got relegated? Good to watch argument is a naive one. I've definitely been guilty of that, Baz. I don't know about you.
Well, I think they had a good start to the season. They had a reasonably decent first half of the season. I think in their very first game,
By Liverpool, but they played well.
Yes. So their very first game, they were aesthetically pleasing and got hammered by Liverpool. And I think that seems to have set the tone for the season. But I've seen quite a few of their games since restart, and certainly put paid to the notion that they're the best, worst team ever to play in the Premier League. They're just risibly bad. Their defending is atrocious. Now, they didn't spend, I think, barely any money during the summer after getting promoted, and eight of their team that got beaten by West Ham played in their final game of the Championship last season. But that argument doesn't really wash when you look at Sheffield United, who are also playing with much the same team and doing incredibly well. I don't think anyone's particularly surprised to see Norwich go down, but that their surrender has been really feeble.
Daniel Farker said after the game, with hindsight, he said, you know, I always said we only had like a 5% chance of staying up at the start of the season. I don't remember him saying that at the start of the season. And Mark, has he got away with it a bit? Because he seems such a lovely fella and he doesn't get a lot of criticism. And you know, as Barry said, no one expected Norwich necessarily to fly this season. But I wonder if he's got off a bit lightly.
He's had a very sort of up and down career at Carrow Road, because when he first arrived, most Norwich fans wanted him out in the first few months. The results were absolutely horrendous, and you know, I think he was probably fortunate to get another season, when of course they then did storm the Championship. In terms of getting away with it, no, I think that they've got a low wage bill. I think there was very much a structure in place that relegation, although not maybe as high as what he said, was still a likely sort of outcome for them. And, you know, he's kind of rode with that. I think that where this kind of best worst team comes from was the first half of the season, when I thought they were unlucky to have as few points as that they'd obtained. They actually were creating chances. They were well in a lot of matches, and it was just sort of fine margins went against them. Then they had a load of injuries that really impacted on them. Now, they were missing sort of 6-7 players, and I think it's very difficult for even established Premier League teams to be without, you know, that amount of kind of your selecting pool. But in recent times, they have given up too easily. 7 straight defeats, only 1 goal scored. Pukki's only scored twice since Christmas as well, which has obviously been a big problem for them. I'm not sure he got away with it. I think that they will have expected to have been relegated. The big issue, I think, for them now is we saw with Huddersfield that when you go on that big losing run at the end of a season, it doesn't automatically mean you can then just restart the championship, you know, as one of the best teams and it'll all go well. And this kind of negative downward spiral, I think the last couple of games could be quite important for them in trying to break that up, because it won't take much to go wrong at the start of next season before I think Farker does come under serious pressure.
Norwich have been relegated 5 times from the Premier League, more than any other side. Matthew writes, which of Sisyphus forever pushing a boulder up a hill and have it roll down again, or Prometheus chained to a rock and forever having his liver ripped out by an eagle, is closest to the experience of Norwich trying to establish themselves in the top flight?
But I think, I'm not sure if there's a Greek myth that really covers it, but I think the perspective here is that, I mean, when they got promoted, they did so after having more than cut their wage bill in half. I mean, the first time they, after going down, the first time they tried to go up again, they had something like the highest wage bill ever in the championship, and it was really sinking the club, and they then really slashed that, sold some players, had a profit, found some dudes no one had ever heard of from here and there, and then they incredibly got promoted, and yeah, they've gone straight back down again, but they've not bet the farm on staying up either, so they're going to take all the parachute payments coming down and presumably continuing building the club. I think, I don't think it's such a disaster, and this is a very specific thing. I don't think there is a Greek myth for this process.
Don't think in Greek mythology, did Jason cut the wage bill of the Argonauts? Did Odysseus break FFP? Did Achilles get one over?
If they'd stayed up, it would have been an underdog story to rival Manchester City's, you know, plucky win over UEFA. But look, nobody supports a team to go and see them get beaten week in and week out. There's no fun in that. So I don't think relegation is any harm. I don't think too many Norwich fans are going to be upset. You would rather see your team be competitive in the Championship than just get hammered every week without fail in the Premier League. You don't go over the edge of a cliff when you get relegated and cease to exist. You know, life goes on. It's not the end of the world.
Quiz time. 4 teams have been relegated from the Premier League. Norwich, obviously, 5 times. Can you name the teams that have been relegated 4 times from the Premier League?
Sunderland.
Correct.
That sounds like something Palace might have done.
Correct.
West Ham?
No, but...
West Brom.
West Brom.
Correct.
West
yes. Brom. One of the Wests, Brom, and one more, quite near Sunderland.
Newcastle.
Correct. Middlesbrough. Well done, everybody. Should mention Antonio's performance. He is a stunning player. Will he be at West Ham next season, Mark Langdon?
Yeah, I would have thought so. I think that West Ham are probably a team that would expect, with the players they've actually got, that should be doing better. And I don't really see Antonio being sort of much better than West Ham. I think he can be part of a more successful West Ham next season. I think what he gives them up front is something that Haller just didn't do for most of the campaign, really, when he was playing there. And that was movement and just offering himself. Haller just seemed to stand up front and expect every pass to go or cross to go straight to him, whereas Antonio fights for every ball and gives the midfielders and defenders much more options. And I mean, he won't get easier goals than those against Norwich. I mean, defending was horrendous.
Bournemouth 4, Leicester 1. Quite the couple of minutes in this game. Leicester sort of cruising along, 1-0 up. Kasper Schmeichel boots the ball his own man. They give away a penalty. Then Soyuncu just sort of ushers Solanke towards the goal, lets him score, and then boots Callum Wilson inside the net and get sent off. It's why I watch football. I'll be brutally honest.
It's obviously completely the wrong way for the round for the defender. You should kick the man first, and then if he does score, then you usher him out of the goal again with the ball. Like, he's gotten a completely wrong way around. I mean, he is a slightly unconventional defender sometimes, Sinyonchu, but I think that is too unconventional. You've gone too far there.
Do you think it looks worse because they're inside the net? It's sort of like a cage fight type thing, Baz? I thought someone might answer the question.
I didn't think it looked like they were in the octagon, no, Max. I didn't think so.
It did. to me.
It was a pretty meat something... kick as far as kicks go.
True, but it just sort of, because they're all sort of stuck in the net, I don't know, that it just made it...
just makes it more confusing, because there's really no point.
But a massive win for Bournemouth. Rob says, I was at school with Solanke in Basingstoke. He was the year below, and I remember when I was in year six, we used to do year five v year six. It was literally a load of 11-year-olds chasing after Dom, who was better than everyone by a mile. Anyone fancy lauding him with praise after scoring?
He had become a bit of an object of ridicule. Liverpool sold him for, I think it was a thick end of 20 million, and Bournemouth just simply were not getting any sort of return for their money, and he was being held up as another example of Eddie Howe's poor record in the transfer market. But the first one he sort of bundled over the line, and it just shows you how quickly confidence can come and go, because his second was an absolute beauty. So I'm pleased for him. You don't want to see someone suffering like that. I'm sure he's always doing his best, but it did look like he had forgotten how to be a footballer. And it's interesting, you know, the margins where he's clearly better by a mile, the best player in his school, and then he becomes a professional and suddenly he's this object of ridicule, because it was quite a barren, 38 games without a Premier League goal, or 38 appearances, many of them, I suppose, off the bench, but... yeah, good luck to him.
He's a striker who has the look to me of someone who will disappear down the Cameron Jerome, Robbie Earnshaw vortex of players who will just absolutely bang them in the Championship, but maybe not quite in the Premier League. But like Barry says, who knows, with a bit of confidence.
Barry, you said, you know, it looked like Solanke had forgotten how to play football for a while. I mean, it did, Mark, look like Leicester City had completely forgotten what on earth they were doing defensive. I mean, it's just so many mistakes. It's amazing. Dermot says, does Brendan Rodgers have his own name inside the envelope? Andrew says, after Leicester's latest defeat, is this clear evidence they value winning the Everton Cup more than getting in the Champions League? And now we have this Cass verdict, right? Fifth place is not enough, and Leicester could fall out of this. And given the start of their season, that would be a disaster.
Yeah, I mean, in 2020, they're 14th in the Premier League over the calendar year, which, for a team that was sort of mixing it, I suppose, with, if not Liverpool, then certainly Man City for the first half of the season, would be seen as a shocker. They would have taken fifth, you know, quite happily at the start of the season. But the second half performance was just so strange. And, you know, this is a team that's now lost to Bournemouth, to Norwich, to Burnley this year, when Burnley weren't playing as well as what they are now. And, you know, Rodgers will have questions against him after what happened against Liverpool, when they couldn't get over the line and what they were trying to do. Is there another sort of late collapse coming? He took Ian Atko off. I didn't quite understand why he did that, because they were completely sort of dominant in that first half. It was just a too bad to be true second half. Really weird to know exactly what went on at half time.
Aston Villa 2, Crystal Palace 0. Larry says, can we get a strip on every jersey marking where the shoulder ends and the arm starts, like a coloured epaulette? He's a weary Crystal Palace fan. Now, Aston Villa were very unlucky with a VAR decision at Manchester United on Thursday, on that evening where VAR got every penalty decision wrong in a brief moment of consistency. this time, Mamadou Sakho, if you were writing a medical textbook and you wanted a picture of where the shoulder exactly is, I would almost use that picture of Mamadou, the ball striking Sakho's shoulder. That is literally the shoulder. And it was overruled by VAR. I don't understand.
Our correspondent has said in jest that there should be a line or a strip on jerseys to signify where the arm ends and the shoulder begins. But I'm pretty sure that is actually in the pipe to happen. As far as I know, yeah, I'm pretty sure I heard the commentator or one of the pundits during the Palace Villa game say that it is coming, or it is a plan. So, I mean, I thought it was a ridiculous decision to disallow that goal, but there's so many ridiculous decisions now. It's just, you know, another one to add to a very, very, very long list.
VAR did get one right, Lars. Jack Grealish. Richard says, where does Grealish's effort rank in the most embarrassing dives of all time? It was absolutely tremendous, because he fell the wrong way. You know, you've got to You've got to, like, I know referees and, you know, who was in charge of the VAR? Was it John Moss? You know, they're not necessarily physicists. But if you're running one way, you can't fall back the other way. It just doesn't, it's not how it works.
It did look a bit like a villain being shot in an old film. And you have these sort of stunt people who presumably don't understand how gravity or basic ballistics work, who just sort of go, ah! And that's it was unfortunate. Listen, like, I don't know. I get less annoyed by this than others. There are some people when you have these sort of obvious dives who said this is, oh, it's killing the game. It's so very bad. Well, you know, Jack Grealish gets kicked around a lot. If you're him, I think it's fair enough. You try to exaggerate and try to get whichever little advantages you can. As the old saying goes, if you're not cheating, you're not trying. But that one he got very badly wrong. I mean, it's not just about being a little bit cheaty. There's an art form to it. You have to dive well. I think we underestimate the importance of diving well, and the ones who just get it wrong look incredibly stupid.
Who's good at diving? Who gets
Bruno
it right?
Bruno Fernandes. Bruno Fernandes is really good at it.
Jamie Vardy is quite good at running into people and makes it look like they've fouled him.
Harry Kane.
Yeah, maybe.
Centre halves are always very bad, so whenever they're in the box for some reason and they try to exaggerate a touch, it just looks really weird.
Watford 2, Newcastle 1. Big win for Watford, big turnaround, two penalties. And if you think how important those two penalties are in the context of Watford season and staying up, the amount of pressure on Troy Deeney, he just took them brilliantly, didn't he, Mark?
He did. Well, I mean, I think any penalty that goes in, you know, you end up just saying, well, you know, that's a good pen. I think goalkeepers kind of know what he's going to do with those penalties, particularly the pressure ones, because he does tend to font them, but goalkeepers just feel like they've got to dive rather than try to stand there. The thing that baffled me about this was Steve Bruce after the game complaining about both penalties. I mean, they were clearly penalties, and then he was going on about clear and obvious. I mean, the clear and obvious line comes into if they want to overturn a decision rather than give them in the first place. He just got really confused by the whole situation. And I think you'll be frustrated because Newcastle were the better team up until that penalty. But when you consider that Watford have got City and Arsenal to come in their remaining fixtures, that and then what happened, you know, on the Sunday, it was absolutely massive. You probably didn't realise at the time just how important those penalties were, because after what happened on Sunday, that they, you know, that they were even bigger.
And all this thing about managers, and you're right with Steve Bruce saying, you know, this is what VAR is for. And it's not. They were both penalties. And this, and I know it's difficult for the touchline reporter, especially now he's, you know, 200 miles away from interviewing the manager. But you would just love one to go, what are you talking about, Steve? They were penalties. It's the same with Solskjaer with the Fernandes thing at Villa. And Solskjaer's like, well, when you do that little double drag back, you're going to get... Someone just going, no, Ollie, that wasn't a penalty. We all know.
I should have done that once, and when I was a post-match reporter, I was in a perfect situation to pull someone up on it, because I chickened out. I didn't do it.
Who?
And Mourinho. Because it was one of those. It was when he was about to lose his sort of unbeaten or unbeaten at home streak against West Brom or something at Chelsea. And then they got a late pen because Ramirez had just run into someone and had fallen over. And it was closer to a foul the other way, I think, than an actual penalty. But I hadn't seen a replay. Like, I was sitting in a seat with no monitor, and I'd seen it once with my own eyes, and then it was straight into the post-match interviews. And in comes grumpy Mourinho being grumpy. And I think he specifically disliked me for reasons that are hard to understand, of course. But and I asked him about the penalty, and he just completely sort of did the Mourinho thing and turned it back on the reporter, going sort of, what, did you not think it was a penalty or something like this? And pretended to be sort of incredulous. And I was young and naive and inexperienced, and I completely bottled it.
And are you saying now you're old and experienced and perhaps slightly less naive, you would have said it wasn't a penalty, you idiot?
I would have either found a way of watching the replay or trusted myself or just messaged someone before the game ended are we completely sure that was nonsense or something, which I should have done.
Yes, but would you have actually, but my question is not, would you have seen a replay? My question is, even if you'd seen a million replays, would you have actually said to Jose, you're wrong?
Yeah, probably. Well, which I guess is probably a good thing. It's probably a good thing I don't have that job, and I wouldn't have had it for very long, I'm sure.
West Ham have 34 points, Watford 34, Bournemouth 31, Villa 30. They all won. That was keeps the race going, doesn't it? Elsewhere, Sheffield United 3, Chelsea 0. A stat from the Premier League, McGoldrick and McBurney, the second duo with the surname prefix Muck to score in the same Premier League match for the same side after MacArthur and McManaman for Wigan in 2013. Richard Jolly's next stat of the pod, Sheffield United complete the Premier League season unbeaten against London teams, played 10, won 6, drawn 4, lost 0, 22 points, 5 wins out of 5 at Bramall Lane. And look, what another brilliant performance from Sheffield United, Barry.
Yeah, and I think David McGoldrick deserves immense credit because they were his first Premier League goals of the season as well. But unlike, say, Dominic Solanke, who we were talking about earlier, he brings a hell of a lot to the Sheffield United party beyond goals. And I think some people who don't watch them play very often dismiss him as, oh, well, he's a striker who doesn't score. But he puts in a tremendous amount of work. He drops deep, he plays on the wing, he goes wherever he's needed, he opens spaces for other players, he's a real handful for defenders. So if you don't watch Sheffield United very often, you could be forgiven for assuming that he's just not very good, but Sheffield United fans really do appreciate him despite the fact that he hasn't scored many goals, and the fact that he's constantly involved, either coming off the bench or starting, shows the high regard that Chris Wilder holds him in. But another brilliant team performance for Sheffield United. I did see on Twitter someone was cross with us for not giving them enough praise last week, but we seem to just constantly praise them. And they've had an incredible season in the Premier League, and I can't really think of much else to say about how impressive they've been, because we've said it all before.
I do think this game was, I mean, sort of years and years from now, when we look back on this season and you check the league table for that year for whatever reason, it was, oh, well, that was the year Sheffield United came up on no budget at all with a team full of guys who hadn't really played in the Premier League before and finished top half. You know, what on earth was that? I think this is a really good game to sort of put on to see what on earth was that. I thought that was a game that really showcased everything they do really well in terms of just sort of denying Chelsea the spaces that they wanted to attack in. And also they do this thing when they overload the flanks where you have the wing back obviously in the sort of famous overlapping center house, but also the central midfielders pull really wide constantly and create these sort of overloads, which means one of them inevitably will be in a good space in terms of putting in a cross, so they'll be able to play to the byline. I mean, Sandabag is a good example of that. Norwegian blonde-haired man Sandabag, if you ask someone what position he plays at Sheffield United, I think most people will say he plays central midfield, but he actually described his role in an interview to Norwegian TV the other week as a sort of a wide type role, because you notice the central midfielders pull out all the time and create these overloads. So it's really effective, and it's interesting that teams just haven't figured out a good way of dealing with it yet.
Stat from Duncan Alexander, Kepa's conceded 2 more Premier League goals than Bernd Leno this season, despite facing 58 fewer shots on target. According to Up to Joe, Chelsea had 76% possession, the biggest margin of defeat after having that amount of the ball since records began. And Frank Lampard was pretty disappointed, Mark, wasn't he, after that game?
Yeah, and understandably so. I mean, he also said, though, that nobody expected Chelsea to finish in the top four this season, which massively underplaying. Yes, they lost Hazard and they weren't able to sign players, but they still had, you know, Pulisic and you know, got Willian and you know, lots of other really good sort of attacking players. You know, one away clean sheet just isn't good enough, really, for them. Most goals conceded in the Abramovich era as well. And Kepa, although actually I don't think at Bramall Lane that was his issue, he's been awful for most of the season. Definitely, I think one of the worst goalkeepers in the league on the expected goals and stuff like that, without a doubt. But somebody like Christensen sort of annoys me, because I think he's a very talented centre back, but I don't know, he seems to make mistakes, so he just has these bad games really that I can't work out if he's sort of ever going to really make it at a top club or not. And he was really roughed up by McBurnie and McGoldrick, there's no doubt about that.
Spurs 2, Arsenal 1. A comeback from Spurs. Arsenal have dropped 21 points from winning positions this year. Sky called this a Jose masterclass, Barry.
I suppose it was a Jose masterclass. He gets enough stick on this podcast, so I suppose we should give him a bit of credit where it's due. He pulls results out of the bag against big teams. If I was a Spurs fan, I know it's the hated Gooners, I think I'd be a bit fed up that we'd actually won that game, because I don't know how, I know you've a soft spot for Spurs, but because it just means he's going to be there longer.
I didn't know if I wanted Spurs to win that game.
Yeah, see, that's, and I think it was a big game for both teams, and Arsenal predictably Arsenaled it up. Spurs didn't do anything particularly avant-garde. They sat back and waited for Arsenal to make mistakes, and the mistakes duly arrived.
What percentage is that first goal David Luiz's fault last? Because I thought it was sort of 70% Kolasinac.
Yeah, at least, maybe more. I mean, it looks like it's because he's close to it, but that's a terrible ball to play in from there. I mean, I don't, maybe David Luiz of 5 years ago could have caught up to that, but, you know, no. I feel like that game and the game against Bournemouth is a good little sort of microcosm of where we're at with Mourinho in 2020, which is that we shouldn't really be surprised that he's able to put together this kind of tactical sort of gnarly performance against a rival. And I think he spoke quite, it's actually, I like it when managers, you know, deign to speak about tactics a little bit in the press conference. And he mentioned how they, since Arsenal play with Bellerin and Tierney really wide and high, and then they bring Aubameyang and Pepe and Saka on the inside, he said, I wanted my back four to be focused on closing the central areas and jumping only to the wing backs in special occasions. For that, I needed a sacrifice from Sissoko and Lucas. It would sound a sort of vaguely Mayan in a slightly worrying way, but they did, in terms of working hard, certainly Sissoko and Lucas did provide a sacrifice. And he is really good at, you know, masterminding, I guess, if you want to use the word, of these performances. But then also against Bournemouth, they looked a lot like his sort of Man United team, and there was just kind of this shapeless mess that didn't seem to know what to do when it was their job to run a game. And that is very much the Mourinho experience in this point in time, and maybe it'll get better, but I don't think so.
Liverpool 1, Burnley 1. This draw ends Liverpool's hopes of completing the season with a 100% Premier League home record, which means Sunderland's of 1891-92 remains intact, the only team in the English top flight history to win every home game in a completed season. I mean, the big story from this game was another brilliant performance, Mark, from Nick Pope.
Yeah, and he was, wasn't he? I mean, he kept them in it at 1-0, which enabled, you know, Burnley to then sort of push on in the last 25 minutes or whatever, you know, to snatch their point. But, you know, when you see how bad Jordan Pickford was sort of 24 hours later for Everton at Wolves, and you watch the commanding performance of Pope, and he's probably not as good with his feet as Pickford, but I mean, him and Henderson must be pushing. And I mean, I would be surprised, really, I think, if Pickford did start come next season, you know, next season's European Championship. I think that both Pope and Henderson now should be considered ahead of him. I mean, he made a number of fantastic saves. I mean, yeah, he's right in the running for the Golden Glove award. And it's not just Pope. I mean, you know, they defend well as a team. But ordinarily, Liverpool would have won that game if it wasn't for Pope's brilliance.
You mentioned Jordan Pickford. He was in that Everton team that lost 3-0 at Wolves. Jimenez, then Donka and Jota with the goals. Richard Jolly's next stat: Wolves become the first English club to win competitive games in two different Julys in the same season. Louis says, can any other Everton's be asked? Ancelotti said after the game, I don't want to talk individually about every single player. I said to them, this attitude is not acceptable for me and we have to change immediately. I want to see a different spirit. Sort of an age-old question about Everton, Barry, isn't it? I don't want to say what's the point.
What is the point? I mean, I was on a Zoom press conference with Seamus Coleman about 10 days ago, and, you know, lovely fella. But the question was raised about Everton's lack of consistency, and they were about to play Tottenham and try to win three games in a row for the first time in over a year. And they didn't, obviously, but you could see how infuriated he was by their lack of consistency. On their day, they're a match for anyone, but it's just the players don't seem that arsed. Their fans don't seem that arsed. they never get relegated. They never win anything. So yeah, well, what is the point?
If you are an Everton fan who is arsed, it's at B Glenn Denning, by the way, on Twitter. Sorry, Mark.
No, sort of glossed over the fact that really Wolves just completely dominated Everton, and the structure of their team compared to the mess that Ancelotti put out. And I know he had injuries, but one team looked like they knew what they were doing and one team didn't in their respective sort of formations. And Wolves have, given the news will have been bad for them in terms of what's happened with Man City today, but they do go to Chelsea on the final day. So if they can get themselves back to within, the 2 points or whatever, to turn that into the cliche cup final for a Champions League spot, that they've given themselves an opportunity again. And I thought that for all that Everton were terrible, Wolves actually, were really in control of that game and played well.
And Manchester United Southampton is an 8 o'clock kickoff tonight, Monday night. If Manchester United win that game, they will go above Leicester and above Chelsea into third place in the Premier League table. Just one note that the Premier League are planning for 40% of crowds for the start of next season, which is the 12th of September. I know before the pod, we were discussing how much of a summer holiday we get after the Champions League finishes at the end of August. Not a big one is the answer to that. Fans will always have at least a seat between them. Big issue is those sitting diagonally, with a greater chance of infection, and logistics at older, more congested stadiums as well. So look, one to watch anyway, and that'll do for part two. Part three, we'll round up the Championship and we'll look at the Champions League and Europa League draws. Welcome to part three of the Guardian Football Weekly. We'll do a lot of Championship stuff on Thursday, by the way. It's another midweek fixture list, but a huge goal. I didn't dare text Ellis James, actually, yesterday after Swansea conceded the last minute at home to Leeds United. They need 4 points from the remaining three games to seal promotion. It is worth mentioning that, Leeds have lost three of their legendary players after the passing of Jack Charlton, and there are lots of people who aren't massive Leeds fans, but it would perhaps be fitting for Leeds United to get back into the Premier League this season. They are 3 points ahead of West Brom, who drew at Blackburn. Brentford won 3-1 at Derby. Fulham beat Cardiff 2-0. If Fulham beat West Brom on Tuesday night, then automatic promotion is in Brentford's hands should they win all their remaining games, which would be an amazing achievement for Brentford. The League One playoff final is tonight. 7:30 kickoff at Wembley. Oxford United v Wickham Wanderers. Producer Sammy says that former BBC Breakfast host and Strictly Come Dancing's Bill Turnbull told him that 10 fans were allowed into Wembley from each side. We don't know if it's true, and we're very pleased that the producer of this podcast goes to Bill Turnbull for all his footballing news.
It's an oddly specific thing to make up if it's not true. So I'm prepared to go with it.
Producer Sammy says Bill Turnbull is going to the game. So he's got
it makes more sense then, still.
The Champions League final then. We know what it's going to be. It's going to be Real Madrid or Chelsea or Lyon or Juventus or Napoli or Barcelona or Chelsea or Bayern Munich against RB Leipzig, Atletico Madrid, Atalanta or Paris Saint-Germain. It actually has turned out, Lars, to be quite a fascinating draw, hasn't it? And the fact that it seems quite top heavy, and those four sides in the bottom half, Leipzig, Atletico, Atalanta and PSG, will look at that thinking, we're not going to have a better chance for a long time.
No, that's true. Atalanta in particular will probably not have a better chance anytime soon. And they've been playing magnificently of late, really. I mean, desperately unfortunate not to beat Juventus the other day. I mean, at times really wiped the floor with them. It was quite something. And in this sort of compressed knockout thing, maybe they do have a chance. It opens up for that. Yes, I'm excited about that draw. That's fun.
I like that you say they were desperately unfortunate against Juventus. Another underdog story. Plucky Juventus.
You may recall, Barry,
somehow managed to get a result against all odds.
You may recall that if you were active on the notable social media site Twitter on the evening, I may have written a missive on that website where I suggested in the first half that Atalanta are playing so well now that a soft Juve penalty seems inevitable, and they got two. I mean, we know a thing or two because we've seen a thing or two, I believe, is the phrase.
Mark, what do you make of this draw?
Yeah, I think it's definitely going to be really interesting in that half, that softer half of the draw, because I've had some people say to me, oh, it'll suit an Atalanta because a one-legged tie will suit an attacking team. And then I've had other people say to me, it will definitely suit a more defensive team like Atletico Madrid. So I don't think we know who it's going to suit at this stage. One team that it definitely won't suit is somebody like Barcelona, Quique Setién, probably basing, his job, can he win the Champions League? Because if they miss out on La Liga, it would have been a really bad season for them to have to beat, first of all, Napoli, overturn that deficit, to win that game, with no fans at Nou Camp and progress. And then you've got the, taking on Bayern Munich and then probably Manchester City. I mean, we don't know yet, but I mean, that would be some feat, I would say, and they don't look up to that. So I think somebody like Barcelona, who will have been hoping that the Champions League could save their season, to have been handed that kind of draw, and Juventus as well, another team that, have based a lot around their signings on winning the Champions League, Cristiano Ronaldo being the obvious one. To have to beat, first of all, Lyon, but then Manchester City and then probably Bayern Munich just to get to the final. Really hard for those. Nobody's really mentioning Paris Saint-Germain. I think that will probably suit them. I mean, they've been handed what looks like a really nice draw if they can just sort themselves out in terms of, just the fitness, because they won't have played. We've got these two cup finals coming up. Whether that's enough against sort of, teams that are battle-hardened, I'm not so sure.
I mean, and that is an interesting thing here that we've got. Certainly, I would say the most fun team to watch in the world right now, and certainly the most likable team left in the competition in Atalanta, facing PSG, of all things. And I mean, I guess the way these things go, I suspect, just because the share, as much as Neymar is a nitwit, I mean, the sheer quality of that PSG front line, even if they are a bit rusty, You do wonder. I mean, I suppose it would be in the spirit of today, really, if we get a PSG Man City final this year. Very much the way it seems to be going. So maybe that's what we'll get.
I'm not sure you can. I mean, I think the rustiness of PSG and Lyon, you'd imagine it would be a huge factor against them. I can't see how they would overcome. I'm not even sure. Have they been training away all time?
They played an exhibition, a friendly game yesterday against a team in the lower leagues. They won. Neymar was on target. That they are now back in training and playing friendly matches, and they've got a couple of domestic cup finals that will be used, I suppose, in preparation for the Champions League.
Just in case you haven't been following it at all, it's all going to be held in Portugal, and the quarterfinals are on the 12th, 13th, 14th, 15th of August. Then the semi-finals the following week, and the final on the 23rd. I mean, it will be a bit like a World Cup. It will be great. And the Europa League draw was done as well. Manchester United, Rangers and Wolves all still in that. The quarterfinal, semi-final and final will be played as one-off matches held in Germany at Duisburg, Fortuna Dusseldorf and Schalke and Cologne. Wolves and Man United could meet each other in an all-English semi-final. Mark, give us the winners of the Europa League.
Yeah, I mean, Manchester United definitely are deserving favourites. They've been handed a really nice draw in the quarterfinals, Basaksehir or Copenhagen. But I think the Inter, having not done as well as they will have expected in terms of Serie A, this is an opportunity, and also in the Champions League, this is an opportunity for them maybe to save their season. They've still got a lot of quality. Conte's got a little bit to prove, I think, in terms of the sort of European competitions. This may be in the right direction for them.
Finally, just a couple of questions before we finish. Stu says, amongst others to reference this in some way, has Mark used lockdown as an opportunity to, quote, get into vegetables?
Well, slightly long story, but I have been eating some corn. But I'm probably the only person in sort of Britain that's managed to do that and their life expectancy go down, because I can only eat it with like copious amounts of butter. So it's kind of really just butter with a little bit of corn dotted in to it. But it's really nice. So yeah, corn.
Is it hot take, sweet corn, Mark Langdon? Actually, one of the least pleasant vegetables.
Just put a lot of butter on it. Certainly. It's the solution to everything.
Or just eat butter, I guess.
What prompted you to really push the boundaries there, Mark?
It was locked down into the extent that I don't usually eat breakfast, but where I found myself sort of sitting indoors for large periods, like, I bought some crumpets and I needed some high quality butter to go with it, because my wife usually uses some sort of low fat nonsense. And so I had the butter and I just remembered how nice butter was, and I was thinking of ways that I could sort of eat the butter, and that felt like a sneaky way to be able to get some butter in me for some sweet corn.
I mean,
oh, well, there's no better way to end this podcast, is there? There you go. If you learn nothing from it, butter is nice. Thank you so much, Mark, for your time.
Thank you.
Thank you, Barry.
You're welcome.
Cheers, Lars.
Thank you, Max.
As I said, Barney Bronay, Tarek Pandya join us tomorrow when we'll look in a bit more detail at that verdict from CAS Manchester City playing in the Champions League next season.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.